Good evening. My name is James Thomas and welcome to my podcast series, Don't Let God Put You Off the Bible. In 2003, the Da Vinci Code was published and by 2009 it had sold 80 million copies worldwide. This just proved that, despite a general move away from formalised religion in the West, biblical mysteries still have the power to capture the world's imagination. And the news headline for this podcast series is that, if you take your time to look for them, the Bible is full of similar intrigues and anomalies that throw up some very peculiar lines of questioning and, in fact, they have even more fundamental implications than the ideas put forward by Dan Brown's book. I'm not for a moment here saying that the Da Vinci Code plot should be taken too seriously, but I think it's been beaten up enough by some really quite heavyweight scholars whom I sometimes question as to why they are bothering to spend their time addressing what is, essentially, a work of fiction. They come across as feeling they need to defend the curious layperson, false teachings, and the wily cunning of unscrupulous storytellers. But, to my mind, I think that we have to credit the book-buying public with a shrewd intelligence. Yes, maybe the book stretches truths and plays with facts, but you know, it's a ripping yarn, so who cares? The subjects in this series of podcasts are the real mysteries and puzzles and intriguing hidden clues to fascinating backstories in the scriptures themselves and in writings that date back to the first few centuries AD. Some of you may have heard or read material on these subjects before, but for others, most certainly, this will be a real eye-opener and certainly suggest an alternative history that, if ever proved, would be just as shocking as anything fiction has to offer. Before we dig into our first topic, I will just say that I am conducting these podcasts more in the spirit of a general, light-hearted overview of the chosen subjects rather than an academic investigation. And just in case I find myself taking things too seriously, I will always have an emergency glass of my favourite whiskey to hand as an instant cure for pomposity. These podcasts are for people with a curious mind and not advanced students of the field, and as such, I won't be providing references to source material, and if you want that kind of material, you will just have to buy the appropriate academic books, the direction of which I am happy to point you towards. The people who I want to interest will not want to be bogged down in torrents of dry reference work. But I will state that no proposition that I mention here will be just my personal biased musings. They all come from the pens of extremely credible scholars, even if I do paraphrase them on occasion. Stick with me and you'll be okay, kiddo. So fill your glass and let's get into the first intrigue. Whatever happened to the Dead Sea Scrolls? Between 1947 and 1956, what was later to be described as the most important find of ancient scrolls in modern times was discovered in a series of caves running along the northwest shore of the Dead Sea in Palestine or Israel. A very few of the scrolls were pretty much complete, but most were found as just piles of fragments, which would make reconstruction a very painstaking process. Many of the scrolls were thought to have been written in the 2nd and 1st century BC, and rumours circulated that a few may even have been written in the 1st century AD, right when Jesus was roaming the Galilee. Speculation exploded amongst scholars and the public as to what secrets could be hidden in the scrolls. Could they give a completely new perspective on the beliefs and events right in the time and place that was to give birth to what would eventually come to be called the Western world? Scroll on well over half a century later to now, go out into the street and ask the people on the street how did the Dead Sea Scrolls change our understanding of ancient history and just see the reaction you get. So the story of this podcast is, whatever did happen to the Dead Sea Scrolls? Soon after the discovery of the scrolls, they were passed to a select group of scholars who were tasked with piecing the fragments back together and then translating their content.
The world held its breath, waiting to see what revelations would be unveiled. It held its breath, and it held its breath. It held its breath until, staggering though it might be, the dawn of the 90s, before the bulk of the scrolls were made available to everyone and not kept in firm control of an incredibly elitist group of scholars. In fact, to see the very last scroll published, the world held its breath for 55 years. The last scroll was not released until 2002. And there were a lot of conspiracy theories going on as to why this was. There were secrets being suppressed. They didn't want certain things to get out to the public because it would rock the very foundations of our belief in Jesus or Christianity. The rather more mundane truth is that scholars wanted to absolutely ensure when they published their translation and notes on the scrolls that they were responsible for translating, that their study was complete and comprehensive in total. They didn't want anybody saying, you missed this, you didn't see that. They wanted theirs to be the last word. And so they would go over the work again and again and again, and it was a very slow process. There were some who were quicker than others, but in general, it was a painful process of checking and rechecking and paranoia, which was the biggest problem of all. But when they did eventually come out, there seemed to be no revelations, no history-changing discoveries. The scroll had been absorbed by the scholarly community, and when they were released back out to the world, the initial shockwave of the discovery had died away. Why had it taken so long to publish them? And where were the jaw-dropping revelations they were meant to have held, according to some? That is exactly what we are going to look at in this podcast. The discovery and subsequent activity that surrounded the Dead Sea Scrolls is a tale of fortune and war and intrigue and even secret agents. It's not my aim here to go into this story. There are several documentaries that you can watch on YouTube that do a perfectly good job of doing this, and I would recommend that you watch one. The BBC have a very good one if you want to watch that. But before I can get into unpacking what I really want to talk about, you do need at least a little background knowledge. In the 1st and 2nd centuries BC and the 1st century AD, oh, and by the way, I know BCE and CE are more politically correct terms, but the reason I'm using BC and AD is because I choose simplicity over political correctness. Moving on. In this time period, a disaffected sect of Jews had deserted Jerusalem and the temple and set up camp in the barren wilderness that ran along the shore of the Dead Sea. They had no time for the pandering of the priests of the temple to the Romans and, in their opinion, their rather lax interpretation of the Jewish law. This sect was apocalyptic in their beliefs, which means they believed that this current evil age was going to come to an end with an almighty battle between the forces of light, the sect members, and the forces of dark, the devil and all evil, and everybody else, including Jews, who were not in their sect. They spent a lot of their time copying out books from the Old Testament, and 200 of the scrolls and scroll fragments were from these copies. But the rest of the scrolls were documents of their own writing. From now on, these scrolls that were of their own authorship, I shall call the secular scrolls, because they reflect the belief and customs of the Qumran sect. Simple. They wrote about the laws to be followed by the community members. They wrote about how the final battle between good and evil will be played out. And they wrote an awful lot of what are called peshas. These are commentary on the Old Testament books, applying their meanings to the current situation the sect found itself in. Rather like people today who interpret the book of Revelation in the New Testament as being a prediction of events in our time. The secular scrolls were of particular interest to some because they shed new light on what beliefs were abroad in and around the time of Christ, right in his homeland. And don't forget, Jesus was a Jew through and through, and so were the members of the Qumran community. So the little group of scholars made themselves comfy and began to scholar. To them, intriguing mysteries started to surface, such as to which Jewish group did the Qumran community members belong to? Were they Essenes or could they be Sadducees? Were all the scrolls written out at Qumran or were some brought in from Jerusalem? Were the sect members married or did they practice celibacy there? Fascinating stuff to them, but to the general public with a bright interest but not expansive knowledge of the period's history, this was just so much nitpicking and not the stuff of a thick-eared thriller capable of blasting them out of their reading chairs. Arguments in different camps hinged on the translation of single sentences or even words within the scrolls. Things got highly technical very quickly, and this, to be honest, is where the scholars felt most comfortable. However, there was one curiosity within the scrolls that really did have the potential to grab public interest. Within the sectarian literature found at Qumran, certain individuals of the time were mentioned, not by name, but by the scribes' own coded titles for them. There was the angry young lion, the righteous teacher, the wicked priest, the liar, or the spouter of lying. The challenge was, of course, to try and match these coded names to any known historical figures of the time. If the scholars could know who was thought of as righteous and who was considered a liar or wicked, then this would shed new light on attitudes of certain Jewish sects in the period running up to the time of Jesus. And here is the key thing. Fairly soon, it was generally agreed by the exclusive elite who had access to the scrolls that the archaeological and paleographic evidence pointed to the critical documents being written in the 2nd and 1st centuries BC. So none of the coded names could have been used for any New Testament figures. This conclusion effectively removed the scrolls from general public interest, and the scholars could return to mooching around at a leisurely pace discussing tiny points of intricate arguments. Perfect for them.
But when the scrolls began to be grudgingly made available to all in the very early 90s, scholars and historians from far wider backgrounds were given the opportunity to study them and weigh in with their own thoughts and conclusions. Now, for those of you that aren't familiar with how the scholastic world works, I need to give you some background information. As a scholar, when you publish something, you want it to and need it to be taking a fresh look at the subject matter. It's a crowded marketplace, especially in the biblical world, and you have to have a new take to be noticed at all. But, and this is the real catch, you can't stray too far from the conventional thinking, or you will be instantly savaged by the pack, branded as a maverick and ostracised to the lunatic fringe. You will be doomed to never being taken seriously again, and everybody else will be just fine with that, because that's one less competitor in a very crowded field. This is a kind of regulating valve. I'm sure it's not done intentionally for this reason, but it's a kind of regulating valve that makes sure there's no dramatic change in orthodox thinking over a short space of time. So one person isn't going to publish something radically different than what the conventional thinking is already, and everybody go over to it. There's a gradual process of change of thinking over longer stretches of time. So this need to stay near the convention stops things just popping out from nowhere and one person suddenly getting all the recognition for a completely different way of thinking. It doesn't happen in this valve where, yes, we want to hear something new, but don't be too radical, because if you are, we're going to point our fingers and laugh at you. It's a regulating valve. Not intentional, as I say, but it just has that effect, that thinking within the scholastic world, in the biblical scholastic world, it moves forward at a fairly glacial pace. But as sure as X is X, some fairly controversial theories began to be published. For example, one claim was that the righteous teacher was John the Baptist, and one work hailed him to be none other than Jesus. These and several other theories about various aspects of the Qumran scrolls were quickly jumped on, and not surprisingly, as they were based on fairly thin scholarship, if any at all. Scholars did what scholars do best and buried the game ball in a big pile of mud in the middle of the pitch. The technicalities of the arguments that they used to dismiss the more outlandish claims would have glazed the eyes of even the most inquisitive eavesdropper. The controversies that were taken on board by serious scholars, such as they were confined to very high-level technical points which would have left most people none the wiser, even if they had been proved one way or another. For example, if I said to you that it had been proven and accepted by all major figures in the field that the inhabitants of Qumran were female as well as male, would that drop your jaw? I doubt it. So by the late 90s, public curiosity was minimal, and now, as I said before, if you walked down a street and asked 100 people what did the Dead Sea Scrolls reveal to us, I doubt you would find 1 in 10 that had any real grasp for what they actually were. But rewinding back to the beginning of the 90s, a certain person did step forward and threatened to set a bomb under the whole rather dusty edifice that was the study of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Step forward one Professor Robert Eisenman, American Bible and Ancient Text scholar, currently Professor of Middle East Religions, Archaeology and Islamic Law, and Director of the Institute for the Study of Judeo-Christian Origins at California State University, Long Beach. Professor Eisenman had very controversial views on the real identities of the righteous teacher, the wicked priest, and the spouter of lies, the characters referred to in the scrolls by these coded names. And, as far as the academic world was concerned, there was one big problem. Professor Eisenman's credentials were so impeccable that he did not need approval or recognition by his peers or of his theories. He had his own credibility ecosystem bubble. He could not be marginalised as a maverick or a kook because of his standing with his own field of expertise. He was standing alone, and it would be very, very difficult for people to laugh him off as a knowledgeable layman. He was right at the centre of things. He'd been right at the centre of the struggle to get the scrolls released for general study. And then he ended up right at the centre of the controversies that surrounded who were the coded people. Now, it doesn't matter where I start here. There's always going to be something I should explain first. So I'm just going to cut right to the core and work out from there. Here is what Professor Eisenman proposed. The spouter of lies was none other than Paul. Yes, that's right, Saint Paul, the one struck down on the road to Damascus. The man who many say is the most important figure in Christianity after Jesus. The righteous teacher, he claimed, was James, the brother of Jesus. The brother of Jesus? That ruffled a few feathers. And finally, the wicked priest was Ananus ben Ananus, the priest who, in around 62 AD, presided over the slaughter of James, the brother of Jesus. His proposal was a kind of Russian doll of explosive ideas. You open the first one, and there's another one inside, and another one inside of that one, each one making even more eyes pop than the one before. And, of course, the crucial point here is that if he was right, then this would date some of the crucial scrolls slap dab into the first century, a point the scroll scholars had never conceded. Can you imagine just how many sides of the world of religious studies, faith-based or otherwise, these propositions came into direct conflict with? The thing with Professor Eisenman was that he was cut from a different cloth than most other scholars in his field. He was charismatic, he was cool, he wrote poetry, and even had a couple of what could be seen as romantic novels published. He bummed his way through Asia and Europe when he was younger, just learning stuff in real time. But on the other hand, he had an Ivy League education at Cornell. Under his belt, he had a degree in physics and philosophy, even before he started to study the ancient Near East. He had a laser-like intellect, and what's more, he had the kind of personality that quite enjoyed ruffling feathers. He was quite capable of bursting through a saloon door and firing from both hips with a grin on his face. With the publication of Maccabees, Zadokites, Christians and Qumran, a new hypothesis of Qumran origins, he lit the touch paper, but he did not retire. And with his later publication of James, the Brother of Jesus, he really started spraying the bar with bullets. So let's look more closely at what he was claiming and its implications. By stating that the code names in the secular scrolls were referring to first century figures, he was straight off the bat implying that the established Qumran scholar team had got their dating wrong. They claimed that there was no significant scrolls there that dated to the first century AD, although the sect definitely inhabited Qumran at that time. In my opinion, one of Robert's most powerful arguments against this is that right from the start of the first century, Judea was slowly becoming a pressure cooker of religious and political tensions that would eventually culminate in the destruction of Jerusalem and the burning and sacking of the sacred temple by the Romans. Should we really believe that a sect so prolific in its output of writing sat on its hands for this whole time and wrote absolutely nothing? It was a series of events that would see their camp entirely obliterated, and they had never had a mind to record their views for posterity. You have to say, it's unlikely. In his first book, Robert called into question the paleographic and archaeological evidence amassed by the Qumran scholars in a comprehensive deconstruction of their findings. Paleography is a method of dating texts by looking at the writing and language and seeing when that was in common use. A bit like we could easily tell a 19th century book from a 21st century book simply by looking at the language used. Very broadly, Robert argued that whatever archaeological or paleographic evidence was pointing towards, you had to take note of the actual content of the text, the internal data. And to Robert, the content of many of the scrolls was saying one thing: we are first century. So, if the key scrolls were first century AD, then there was a real possibility that the identification of the characters behind the coded names by Robert was correct. And if he was right, then it would upset more than an apple cart. Let's have a look at why exactly. And I'll warn you right now, things might start shooting off at strange tangents all over the place. But stick with it and we will get back to the main trail soon. But to get across the points in this shorter time, it has to be done this way. So try and bear with me. If Professor Eisenman was right and the righteous teacher, respected in the Qumran community, was James the brother of Jesus, then this would give James a much higher significance and importance at the time than which has since been credited to him. I know what you might be thinking, but who says Jesus had a real brother? The Bible says it was his milk brother or his cousin by birth. The fact is, there is enough extra-biblical material written about James to convince most serious scholars that not only did James, a real brother of Jesus, exist, but he also succeeded Jesus as the head of the Jerusalem community after his death in around 30 AD. I may do a later podcast about the evidence for James, but for this particular podcast, I don't like saying it, but we have to take that as read. I can't give you all the references here, but just as a pointer, Josephus, a first century Jewish historian, details his death in a book called The Jewish Antiquities, written in the 90s AD. And Hegesippus, a Christian writer, probably a Jewish convert, writing in the mid-second century, also writes about James and, detailing his death, claims he was buried right where he fell from the temple pinnacle down into the Kidron Valley, and a marker was placed on his grave. Eusebius in the 4th century also claims to have seen the grave marker in his time, as does Jerome in the 5th century. Oh, and by the way, Jesus appears to have had three other brothers, Simon, Jude, and Joseph. And to put the cherry on top of the cake, he probably had a sister called Salome. At this point, I'd like to address what some may be viewing as the elephant in the room, which is I seem to be assuming Jesus did actually exist, which is a real rip-snorter of an assumption, isn't it? Well, it isn't really. There is the Jesus of the New Testament, the Son of God with his miracles and love of everyone, and then there is the historical Jesus. Again, most serious scholars in the biblical study field now would all agree there was an historical Jesus. I'm not including the conspiracy theorists that you can find on YouTube or the sensationalist book writers, but only the serious scholars who spend their time painstakingly combing through ancient material, such as it is, trying to reconstruct what really did happen in Palestine in the first century AD. The historical Jesus is a shadowy figure. But if you look very carefully, you can sometimes find him shimmering in the background of a biblical parable or speech. His true words, actions and beliefs have to be sieved out from amongst a landslide of legend and religious propaganda. But it can be done, and when you've finished, there still remains a man. A man who had radical beliefs on how to practice the Jewish religion. One whose strong will brought him into conflict with both the hierarchy of the synagogues and the Roman overlords. He caused enough unrest for the Romans to have him crucified, and shortly after, his followers came to believe he had risen from the dead. His followers came to believe he had risen from the dead. This, at least, seems to be the bones of the historical Jesus. I will mention at this point, Jesus wasn't a one-off messiah. They popped up all over the place at different times with their own claims, and it has to be said, most of them met fates almost as grisly as Jesus did. You can read about them in numerous ancient texts, including the Bible. There is nothing fantastical about a religious and wise man living in first century Palestine who people came to believe in as a messiah figure. The claims that are difficult to swallow came after Jesus' death. So, Robert Eisenman identifies the righteous teacher as James. But what does this mean? Let's jump back to James taking over from Jesus as the head of the Jerusalem assembly. This would indicate that James had similar views to Jesus and the torch had been passed on to him. That makes sense. But if James was a righteous teacher of the Dead Sea Scrolls, a man who the Qumran community respected and were guided by, then he must have had sympathy with their beliefs and way of life. And if that's the case, this would make James, and therefore Jesus, who he followed, far more extremist in their views than the impression the Bible gives. The Qumran community believed there was soon to be a violent battle between the powers of darkness, such as the Romans and the Sons of Light, them. Not all Jews, just them. Anyone outside of the Qumran sect was on the side of darkness, and that included other Jews. They were the only ones who were practicing the religion of their God as he wished. Everyone else had sold out to the Romans and found loopholes in the scriptures to make keeping the law easier. Now, just hold that thought there, and we'll skip on to who Professor Eisenman identified as the spouter of lies. This, he says, was Paul. Paul, the man responsible for spreading Christianity throughout the Roman Empire, and, as I mentioned earlier, is identified by many as the second most important figure in the religion for his work done on setting the bedrock of Christian theology. The Qumran community despised what they saw as the spouter of lying's corruption and watering down of Jewish practices. He would have been classed by them as a seeker of smooth things. That's a phrase they use over and over again. Someone always looking for an easy get out from the Jewish law and a willingness to accommodate the Romans for a quiet life. But if this was the case and James was in sympathy with Qumran views, wouldn't James have come into conflict with Paul in a major way? And being the leader of the Jerusalem community, would he have allowed him to preach to all and sundry beliefs he himself didn't support? Surely they would have come head to head at some point. Well, guess what? The New Testament itself provides us with evidence that this is exactly what happened. In Galatians, Paul is writing to a group of Christians he founded in Galatia in what is modern-day Turkey. When he first visited, he was preaching that there was no need to keep the old laws like circumcision or not eating food, and therefore there was no problem with sitting with Gentiles to eat. The next thing he knows, other Jews have paid a visit to the Galatians and started convincing them that the law should be obeyed and that they do need to be circumcised. Paul is absolutely incandescent with rage, and his letter to them shows clearly his anger. I'll quote you from it, Galatians 2:11 and following. But when Peter was come to Antioch, I withstood him to his face, because he was to blame. For before that, certain came from James. Paul mentions here, came from James. He's putting James as the leader of the community. For before that certain came from James, he did eat with Gentiles. But when they were come, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision. And the other Jews dissembled likewise with him. End of quote. It makes it quite clear in Galatians that when Peter was with Paul, he seemed happy to go along with the idea that all you need for redemption is to believe in the resurrection of Christ and live by your faith. No law required. But as soon as a party sent by James turns up, he starts acting like a good Jew again, and Paul was not happy at all. There is no doubt there was a big rift between Paul, who was out converting Gentiles all over the place, and James and the Jerusalem community. The rift was so serious, even Paul's trusted travelling companion Barnabas leaves and goes his separate ways. Careful study seems to show quite clearly that what Paul was teaching and what the first Christians of Jesus' time believed were very different. In fact, some scholars would encapsulate this difference with a really quite neat description. The religion of Jesus became the religion about Jesus. And it seems quite clear that James and his crew did not like that one little bit. In both Acts and Paul's letters, a meeting took place in Jerusalem between Paul and James about 14 years after he had converted to believing in Jesus as the Messiah. The basics of what Paul should be teaching were thrashed out and an agreement was reached. And it appears at first sight that an amicable compromise was agreed on. But in Paul's letters, it seems to indicate that this agreement was either incorrectly reported or based on a very shaky truce. The animosity between Paul and James seems to have very much continued, with Peter and Barnabas both distancing themselves from Paul and his inclusive teachings, Paul being left with only Gentile converts to accompany him on his travels. From this point on in the argument, you can only look at the situation and draw certain conclusions based on logical thinking. There is simply not enough reliable evidence available to give proof positive about anything regarding the life and attitudes of Jesus. For this reason, any theory about him at some point has to diverge from the safe path and start to be based on likelihoods, not facts. So, if James was the successor to Jesus as the leader of the Christian community, by the way, it wasn't called that then. In fact, the term Christians for the new version of the Jewish religion didn't get coined until some 25 years later or so. But just for ease, I will refer to them as Christians. If James succeeded Jesus, wasn't he most likely to reflect what Jesus believed and what his values were? So, if Robert Eisenman is right, what kind of man is the Jesus we are left with? Well, certainly he would have seen the Jewish law as crucial to his faith, and he would not have approved of anyone who preached that it was not central to redemption, which is exactly what Paul was preaching. He did have his disagreements with various priestly sects, such as the Pharisees and Sadducees, but these were disagreements on interpretation of the law, not whether or not the law should be followed. And bearing in mind James's attitude towards Paul's belief, as borne out by Galatians, it seems that Jesus would not have been particularly happy to sit and eat with Gentiles, never mind prostitutes and tax collectors, or to take such a diplomatic approach to cooperation with the Romans. And this is also suggested when you read the Gospels carefully. Jesus overwhelmingly preaches to the Jews and only interacts with Gentiles when they approach him. Robert Eisenman bases a lot of his argument that James was the righteous teacher spoken about in the Dead Sea Scrolls on an analysis of the language used. He shows that in many of the sectarian texts they use language that was in common use in the first century. Not general language, but religious terms that were used a lot in other first century documents, including the New Testament. Hegesippus, for example, a first century Christian writer, certainly refers to James as the righteous teacher. So it was a name definitely associated with James. By studying the language used in the scrolls, Eisenman gives convincing arguments that they have reference to James, Paul, and Ananus ben Ananus, all first century figures key to events in Palestine and the fragmentation of the Jewish religion. No other scholar, in my opinion, has managed to come up with a more convincing set of matches to the coded names in the scrolls. I am not stating he is right, but what I'm saying is no argument or evidence exists yet that makes me feel he is wrong. Over the course of several essays and several books, the professor shows that, despite conclusions drawn by archaeologists and the indications of the paleography of the scrolls, the actual internal data, what is actually written, has very strong indications that it were penned in the first century. Now, in a proper academic paper, I would have to give examples of this, but to do that, I would have to give so much background information. And really, my intention is just to give you an overview of the situation. If you want to look deeper into this, just let me know and I'll be happy to point you to the right texts. Whenever you read books or listen to lectures given by academics, there will always be a section where they give examples of the slightly more radical theories held by certain people about the origins and meanings of the Dead Sea Scrolls. For example, one academic believes that he has found a fragment of the Gospel of Mark in the surviving texts. Of course, finding any New Testament writings in the Dead Sea Scrolls would be a fantastic find, proof positive that the Essenes had some respect for the newly emerging cult that was to become Christianity. And it would, of course, be absolute proof that the scrolls were being written in the first century. The problem is that the fragment only has one word on it. He won't convince many, that's for sure. But whenever scholars get around to addressing Robert Eisenman's argument, the only thing they ever level against it is that the carbon dating makes it impossible for James to have been the righteous teacher. They never dig into his general arguments because they are just too bulletproof. Nothing he states can be pulled apart, and it is all meticulously researched. So, as unbiased but interested observers, we have to draw the conclusion from what we see and read that there does seem to be an inconsistency between the archaeology and paleography that a majority of the mainstream academics pin their colours to, and the internal data indications of the text as detailed by Professor Eisenman. It's real and it has not been resolved. Unfortunately, the academic world has a neat trick of just ignoring something long enough for the general interest to die down. In his younger days, Eisenman put a huge amount of energy into getting his findings out into the public domain. But he is getting on in age now, and there's no doubt that he has lost some of that formidable sharpness of thought that made his arguments so unassailable in earlier years. The issue is still there, but few know about it, and fewer care, because they don't realise the implications if Professor Eisenman is right. If he is, then we will have to tear up our current image of Jesus and come up with a far more punchy, aggressive, xenophobic, nationalistic messiah who wasn't quite so keen on Gentiles or Romans. And, interestingly, this would far more fit the profile of every other candidate for messiahship before and after him. And, as I've said, there were many, as recorded by first century historians and even the New Testament. So, yes, there is an intriguing puzzle wrapped up in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but the scholarly world has done a great job of banding together and jostling it off the main road to leave it lying in the earth, forgotten and passed by. Okay, well, I hope at least this has given you the appetite to delve a little deeper into the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I hope to see you back to listen to the next little mystery that I'll be unearthing in a couple of weeks' time. There is another section to this podcast, the final section, which is where I retire to the podcast Don't Let God Put You Off the Bible bar, where we can lounge in a corner over a drink and we can pick over the remains of the podcast and see what little details we can unearth, scavenge a few extra facts. Very informal, and if you're coming, bring yourself a drink along. I'm James Thomas, and it's been an honour to have your company. Thank you. Hello, and welcome to everyone who has decided to join me in the Don't Let God Put You Off the Bible podcast debriefing bar. It's a cosy little ingle nook where we can pick through the carcass of the podcast and see what intrigues I could have mentioned but maybe didn't, and also highlight a few key points that have been thrown up. What do I have here? It's a 12-year-old single malt Speyside whiskey. Don't get me wrong, I'm more than happy downing a couple of glasses of White and McKay's blended rocket fuel, but if my daughter chooses to go down the exclusive whiskey aisle at Tesco's on my birthdays and Christmas, then who am I? Anyway, cheers. That's very nice. I think there is a poetic outcome to Robert Eisenman's study of the Dead Sea Scrolls and their possible referencing to James, the brother of Jesus. I think his incredibly detailed research into practically every mention of James in historical and religious documents up until around the 5th century shows, if nothing else, James can stand as a key figure in the world-shaping events in Palestine in the 1st century. Or put another way, James does not need the Dead Sea Scrolls to confirm his importance in what was eventually to become Christianity. Josephus, the 1st century historian, for example, details his death at the hands of the temple high priest. He took advantage of an exchange of Roman governors. One had left and one was on his way. He took advantage of this power vacuum to carry out what was essentially an illegal execution. This indicates James's opposition to the established temple hierarchy and the animosity felt towards him. Paul, the author of the earliest New Testament documents we have, predating the Gospels by at least 20 years, clearly shows his antagonism towards James, and when he talks about people from Jerusalem, he actually says the son from James. Not the son from Peter or the son from John, it's the son from James. He absolutely sees him as a key figure, despite the fact that he seems to view him as meddlesome and interfering. Clement of Alexandria, a Christian theologian writing in the 2nd and 3rd century, makes a reference to an election held to make James the head of the Jerusalem assembly. Reference after reference can be uncovered to indicate that James was absolutely central to what could be called the opposition party in Jerusalem. And this was opposition, as I said, to the established high priesthood of the temple. Professor Eisenman uses this line of inquiry to show that James held similar views to the inhabitants of Qumran, who certainly detested the ruling high priesthood, and we have the documents to prove it in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But from a general point of view, the highlighting of James's importance and position against the ruling high priesthood is all we need to show him as a key figure. If he is not the righteous teacher of the Dead Sea Scrolls, it matters not. A slew of other references show his importance and his active opposition to the ruling priesthood. So, if this is the case, why is he dealt with in such a shallow way in the New Testament? Take Acts as an example. And I apologise if I'm going to teach my grandmother to suck eggs here, but for those of you that are not familiar with the subject, Acts appears to be part two of the Gospel of Luke and written by the same author. Luke, the Gospel, deals with Jesus' birth, life and death, and Acts tells of what happens after Jesus ascends and the apostles are left to get on with spreading the word. Would you not think that the initial most key event to happen after the ascension of Jesus would be where a new leader is chosen? But what does Acts ponder on? It bangs on about the vote for a candidate to replace Judas Iscariot as an apostle. Not the vote for a new leader of the Jerusalem assembly, but one to sort out a tussle over apostleship. How very odd. Or is it? If you wanted to play James down, then the last thing you'd want to linger over is how he became central and key to the newly emerging faith. Especially if you are writing several decades later and keen to encourage the new look the religion has taken on. You see, we don't have the original New Testament documents. We don't even have the first copies of the originals. We have copies of copies of copies and so on. In fact, the earliest New Testament document we have is dated to around the 2nd century. So, with many rewritings, the original documents probably evolved and changed as the new religion did. But if you read them carefully and know what you are looking for, there are echoes of accounts either written or maybe verbally communicated that have the ring of far earlier times. If you study the wording and timeline of the beginning of Acts, where a new apostle is voted for, it is just possible to see through the smoke and mirrors and find traces of an event bringing James to the fore via a vote to make him leader of the apostles. It's a very intricate task, but it can be done. The cutting and pasting was done well, but it's not perfect. So Acts' very first act, if you like, is to blank out James's promotion and then turn its attention squarely on Peter. And it's not until about halfway through that James suddenly makes an appearance. There's no introduction, and it's as if we should already know who he is. It feels for all the world like a cut and paste goof here. If we take it that the writer of Acts was working from one or more earlier documents, when he decides to mention James, he forgets that earlier he has cut the introduction to him, where he is voted in as the leader of the apostles, and just lifts a slab of text from a document that did actually have initial introduction to James, and puts it in his own edited document. It's a theory, but not a proven one, and it's hard to imagine how you could prove it, to be honest. Interestingly, there are two Jameses in Acts. One has come to be known as James the Greater and the other James the Lesser. And guess who our James is? Of course, he's James the Lesser. James the Greater is James the brother of John, the sons of Zebedee, sons of thunder. This sons of thunder renaming of James and John is never explained. And again, this just feels like the explanation was left somewhere on the cutting room floor. And you have to wonder, is this other James brought in just to, if you like, take away from who was the real or the other more important James? Is this just trying to befuddle the situation? The next major event in Acts is the stoning of Stephen. This character is introduced as part of a group of disciples chosen to do the apostles' donkey work with the poor and needy in the community. Again, this story just pops up out of nowhere and seems just a little odd. However, there is a codex that could throw a spotlight on the possible explanation as to why this story is there at all. This ancient work is called the Pseudo-Clementines. It's called pseudo because the documents claim of being written by Pope Clement I, who was born in the first century, is dubious to say the least. In fact, it clearly wasn't and was probably written in the second or third century. But if you're going to make the pseudo distinction, you may as well add pseudo to all the Gospels because they almost certainly were not written by the people identified as their authors. The difference is that the Gospels themselves don't claim to be written by the people they are named after. These names were attributed a lot later, and it's very doubtful that any gospel, canonical or otherwise, was actually penned by an apostle. But getting back to the point, the Pseudo-Clementines seems, in the beginning at least, to follow a very similar timeline of events to Acts. Acts has the attack on Stephen, and then all the followers, apart from the apostles, it says, fleeing to Jerusalem for fear of, fleeing from Jerusalem for fear of persecution. Paul, at this point called Saul, is hanging around in the background and is actually mentioned in the telling of the stoning of Stephen. While Stephen was being stoned, it says, and I'm paraphrasing here, witnesses laid their clothes at the feet of Saul. Then after this, Saul gets permission to go after the followers wherever he can find them, and he heads off to Damascus. This is where he is miraculously converted. But up until that point, he's out for blood. He wants to round up all the new Christians, not that they were called Christians then, but the new followers of the way, as it was sometimes called, and bring them back for justice. In the Pseudo-Clementines, there is an attack, but not on Stephen, but guess who? James. He is preaching to a crowd of Jews, just as Stephen was to the priests in the Acts story, and persuades many of them to be baptized. An individual named only as the enemy then starts berating James and encouraging the priest to seize him. He then grabs a firebrand and beats him with it, at which point all the priests join in, and having given him a damn good beating, they throw him down some steps and leave him dead, which he isn't. The text does not specifically say Paul is this enemy character, but it is in the marginal notes, and a little further on, the text states that the enemy applies for letters of permission from Caiaphas to pursue the Christians to Damascus, just as Saul does in Acts in the New Testament. After the attack on James, the Clementine relates how the James community had fled to Damascus, feeling they were under threat of death. Acts 9:2 explains that this is exactly what Paul did, and the sequence of events seems to fit perfectly. In other words, the authors of Acts and the Pseudo-Clementines could have been working from the same material, but Acts chooses to take the attack on James by Paul and transform it into a general stoning of an otherwise fairly anonymous character who only later gains prominence for being the first Christian martyr, which we are now calling into question anyway. This is just another example of how the Gospels and Acts airbrush out accounts that put James at the centre of prominent events. I think the problem the writers of the New Testament had was that as the new religion began to develop and change, it got further and further away from any kind of belief system that Jesus would have recognised. And this is reflected in the very difficult relationship between James and Paul. James represents the original followers of Jesus and the theology they believed in, and Paul represents a new, rebooted religion, especially crafted to allow it to be accepted by the Roman rulers. So the belief in Jesus as the Messiah that was held in Palestine began to have less and less in common with the beliefs and theology being touted by a man bent on creating a religion for the future. And I'm not saying that was a bad thing, I'm just saying what I think the differences were. The more you find out about James, the more it becomes clear that there was a split in what was to become Christianity. Palestinian Christianity was stubborn, rebellious, and believed the final battle between good and bad was going to be a real physical battle fought out here on earth ahead of God's kingdom arriving. Again, actually physically here on earth. Overseas Christianity, under Paul's guidance, was becoming far more passive, far more spiritual, to ensure the Romans did not feel threatened by the possibility of an actual power grab here on earth. It has to be taken that, not least because of his family lineage, James reflects far more accurately what values and beliefs Jesus was committed to. And the reason James is so marginalized is that if this was highlighted, it calls into question the entire theology of Christianity. This really does have massive implications. But I'll tell you right now, in 50 years' time, nothing would have changed because that ship has sailed on a one-way journey. So here's the thing. That's a very happening phrase, by the way. You don't say, "I'll explain," anymore. It's, "So here's the thing." It's cool, apparently. So here is the thing. From the moment the general consensus from the scroll scholars went abroad that there were no scrolls discovered written in the first century AD, the Qumran materials were consigned to be a kind of secondary interest to the public. Sure, the documents were interesting, but they didn't have the razzle-dazzling cachet of anything that was penned in the first century. They didn't have that possibility to rewrite history the way documents written at the time of Jesus did. Not in the public's eyes, anyway. If it's first century, the entire world wants to know. If it's more Old Testament, well, that stuff's just stories, isn't it? The single credible proposition that stood to rescue the scrolls from the sole interest of the huddle of elite scholars in Jerusalem was Professor Eisenman's argument for placing some of the scrolls in the first century. If he could do that and then go on to link them to the very early roots of Christianity via James, the razzle-dazzle would have very definitely been back in the building. To my mind, he was fighting against two formidable establishments. First, the establishment of the Orthodox scholarship. As I explained earlier in the podcast, anything too radical will be ambushed and tied down in a barrage of intricate points of argument. Of course, this happened, and being fair to Professor Eisenman, he gave as good as he got. He was more than happy to go toe-to-toe with anyone who wanted to take shots at his theories. But when your argument relies on things like archaeology, paleography and carbon dating being wrong, you really are going to find yourself on a fairly lonely path because of people's perception of these fields of expertise. A huge number of biblical scholars are people of faith, and their natural bias will always colour the position they take when it comes to material that challenges the conventional understanding of the roots of Christianity. So all they had to do was to continue to point to the holy trinity of sciences, if you like, that they claimed disproved Robert's position, and eventually you would go away. And I think, even though it took a lot longer to come about than they had hoped, in essence, this is exactly what happened. Religious orthodoxy is a massive, very old tree with a huge root system stretching around the world. Simply put, it takes more than one man pulling on a rope to upend that tree, however big he is. The second establishment Robert Eisenman was up against was the establishment of faith. I've had personal experience of how deeply entrenched people's faith systems can be. Even when presented with stone-cold truths that directly conflict with beliefs they hold dear, they still possess the seemingly inexhaustible ability to look the other way and hold their faith tight to their chest. It's ironic, really, because Professor Eisenman's work did a lot to reconfirm the existence of evidence for the historical Jesus. But in the end, people were not prepared to accept his ideas at the cost of modifying the perceived character of the man central to their faith. I suppose it comes down to that old truism, poetry is more important than history. Or, as Robert Eisenman puts it, what people think happened is more important than what actually happened. Listen, thank you so much for sticking with me on this first podcast. Of course, when I listened back to it, I wanted to keep rewriting and recording the whole thing. But I didn't, because the quicker I get the first one out here, the quicker I can move on to the next with experience behind me. Onward we march. Your company is valued more than you know, and thank you again. You take care.